From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on a street in Boston where a mobile vaccination unit was serving neighborhood kids. Boston Medical Center began sending mobile units like this one to neighborhoods in mid-April after parents postponed or canceled immunization or well-child visits out of fear their families would be exposed to the coronavirus. It's a trend that doctors have noticed across the country. According to the New York Times, immunizations in the U.S. are dropping at a dangerous rate. The same holds true in more than two dozen countries where national vaccination programs have been suspended. That means even with limited travel, illnesses that can be prevented by vaccines could make their way back to communities. Public health experts say that delays or cancellations in administering vaccines during the pandemic could lead to a different kind of health crisis, one in which millions of children are at risk for illnesses like measles, mumps, rubella, and whooping cough. The Measles and Rubella Initiative reported that more than 117 million children in 37 countries may miss out on measles vaccinations because of the coronavirus outbreak. But the medical community is sending an urgent signal: don't miss your vaccines. This hour, we're joined by local experts who discuss these issues. And parents, have you canceled medical visits for your kids out of fear of being exposed to the virus? It's a real fear that experts say they understand. But they say that doctor's offices, emergency rooms are taking precautions. So if you have questions about what to do or steps being taken at those places to keep kids safe, our panel of experts can help you this hour, and you can call the program and talk with them directly. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. Dr. Stephen Cook is Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's also the Medical Director at the New York State Department of Health. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Cook.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray is here. She's an Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Emergency Medicine at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. Welcome back to you.
Hi. Hello.
Dr. Laura Jean Shipley is here. She's an Associate Medical Director for Accountable Health Partners and Vice Chair for Behavioral and Population Health in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And we will be joined shortly by Dr. Dave Topa, a pediatrician at Pittsford Pediatric Associates. So we have a full panel this hour, lots of expertise for our listeners. And I'd like to start by asking all of our guests about your overall concerns regarding some of these vaccine rates dropping. A primary care physician at Boston Children's Hospital recently told NBC that many vaccine-preventable diseases could be even more dangerous for children than COVID-19. And I'd like to know if you agree. I'll start with you, Dr. Cook.
Well, yes, I think we do have to agree that this could be very serious. I mean, we're talking about diseases that we're not familiar with. We have a health system that's already strained, and we're keeping these diseases away based on herd immunity, which we're losing by not vaccinating children. So is it imminent in the next couple of weeks? I don't think so, but I'm being very concerned because there's a lot of catch-up that will be needed if we can't get these vaccines and getting families to understand that we'll provide these services in a safe way.
Are you worried about a backlog, Dr. Cook, with the vaccinations?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think our systems and our practices are ready to accommodate that because they see it. They're conducting telemedicine visits, but they know the shots still have to be given and are planning. And I think Dr. Shipley and others can talk more about specifically how practices are looking to accommodate that. But it is something that we have to be aware of and try to adjust our flow to meet that need.
Dr. Shipley, I know that that's a concern that you have, and you recently spoke with another news station in town about the situation here in Monroe County. Are we seeing the same kinds of drops in vaccination rates as we're seeing across the country here?
You know, actually, Megan, we're not. And it's not that we don't want to be concerned and proactive about this, but we're really fortunate in the Rochester area and the surrounding region because we really operate as one system of care in our approach to children's physical health and to their social-emotional health. So all of us across the region in private practices who are serving kids, as well as the hospital systems, we've all been working together to assure that our children do not experience sustained fallout from the pandemic. So in the second week of March, when everything started to shut down, pediatric and family medicine primary care providers came together from both hospital systems and all the private practices and developed a proactive primary care surge plan. Just as the hospitals were doing surge planning, we did one for primary care. And the goal in that was to promote physical distancing for patients and limit infection spread, but also, very importantly, to prevent our kids from having the unintended health consequences from the pandemic like you're talking about, vaccine-preventable disease and other things. So we came into the pandemic with quite high rates of vaccination for our children in this region. So we went into the beginning of March looking good. And then immediately in March, across the whole area, we prioritized the youngest children, our newborn babies up through age 2 years, for in-person visits. So hundreds of the youngest children were being brought into offices in a safe fashion while others were being kept out. And so we wanted to make sure that they would not get behind. And it's actually not only getting behind in their vaccines. If you think about what happens for a developing child, there's so much that goes on in those first few years of life in terms of a child's development. It's incredible. It's a million new neural connections per second that are developing in a young child. So it's more than vaccines. It's really important that we recognize that. Vaccines are sort of the thing that people are talking about the most, but it's a child's vision, hearing, their development, their social emotional well-being, that, you know, how their family, what kind of stress their family is under. All of those things make those early visits and all of our preventive visits really critical for kids. So at this point in time, our practices have remained open. We have not had any primary care practices that have not been able to see patients. They all have adequate vaccine supply. And we've now expanded in the last week to seeing kids up through age 5. And now we're moving to prioritize the preteens and the older teens as the next group. So I think what we want people to know is that we actually planned for this. We didn't want to be caught on the back end, and I'm proud of our community for that. But we really do need for families to know it is important and it's really safe to come into all of our practices, whether they're hospital-based or they're out in the community. Our providers are out there ready to receive these kids and to do it in the safest fashion possible.
And Dr. Murray, I know that's something that you spoke with my colleague Brett Dahlberg about. With emergency rooms, you describe them as having a sense of stillness in late March, but they're still safe, and kids that need regular or emergency medical attention should be going to the doctor. What kind of message do you want to pass along to parents and families?
You know, I have complete faith in our healthcare system that we're going to do what's right to keep patients and families safe. You know, I have children who have summer birthdays, and they're both due for vaccinations this year, and their appointments for their well-child checks have been scheduled because I know it's the right thing to do. With regards to emergency departments, you know, if you think about what we're used to doing in an ED, it's we're always ready for anything that walks through the door. And so at baseline, we might have a child being treated for cancer and therefore has a very weakened immune system at the same time as we're treating another child for pneumonia, at the same time as we're treating a child with a broken bone. So we've always been able to make sure that each patient has the various safety precautions that they need based on their own disease process. With the development of the coronavirus and the COVID-19 disease, it's changed things a little bit because it is new to us. So we've added some extra layers on top of all of the things we've always been doing. But I think that we're ready. I am concerned about some of our ongoing numbers for the adult population as well. We know we have data for our local community that people are delaying seeking care for things such as stroke, for things such as heart attack. The average local numbers are people are delaying their care by almost 4 times as much as they were during this time period last year with regards to onset of symptoms and actually seeking care. We know that people are calling ambulances and kind of having their initial evaluation and saying, oh, maybe I should just stay home. Maybe I shouldn't go to the emergency department. And that is certainly very concerning to us because we know that the presence of COVID-19 doesn't cure stroke. It doesn't cure other medical problems. And so we just want to make sure that everybody is getting the care they need. I worked in the emergency department yesterday, and we had all the equipment we needed. We had the protective equipment we needed for ourselves and for our patients. And I have faith that we're going to continue to be able to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Topa, what are you seeing at your practice in Pittsburgh? Are parents expressing concerns? Are they still coming in at the normal rates for vaccinations and well-child visits?
You know, we've really had a a good job, I think, of reaching out to those children who are due for vaccines and for their regular well child visits, now expanding up to age 5, just because, as LJ has said, you know, we're beyond just vaccines, but also trying to make sure we're getting children in for the developmental screens. And we reassure each parent that calls that we're doing the best we can to keep them safe, keep our staff safe, keep everyone safe. Every pediatric office I've talked to so far has gone through the same routines in terms of looking at how they're scheduling patients, looking at the physical layout of the offices, really trying to make sure that we're keeping the risk very, very low for both our patients and our staff. And so we do get some trepidation when parents call, and we try to reassure them. We've still had a few patients who are in that 0 to 5, more in that age 3 to age 5, choose to defer for a little while, but I'm sure other practices are doing the same thing we're doing, where we're keeping a list and making sure that we're staying in close touch with these families.
At what point in the vaccine schedule does being behind become a problem? Is it a month or more? I'm thinking about, we're not going to see schools reopening this school year, but if something were to happen in the fall, does that affect how kids can go back to school? So that question, I'll send it all to all of you. From the medical standpoint, what does being behind mean? And then also, what does it mean for kids who are school age? And I'll start with you, Dr. Cook.
Sorry, I'm on mute there.
Oh, that's
well,
okay.
You know, first of all, we want to be just following our existing laws of, you know, kids being up to date on time for their vaccines at school entry. The younger children are the ones that, you know, we have a lot of vaccines catching up. So it's a little less of a concern perhaps in the school age kids, but we have to be ready for the surge and what that may mean. I mean, it's entirely possible that some of this behavior has to be resumed, and we have to go to more distance learning and finding out how to then fill another set of missed visits or missed vaccination. So I think it represents a challenge of kind of the workforce response. Again, our community has been really ahead of the curve, you know, even prior to this in terms of getting kids vaccinated and being accessible for families. I can't say that's always the same around the rest of the state, because, you know, the adoption of telemedicine has not been nearly as universal. So I think it's something we have to be aware of when school starts, as well as, you know, kids getting into daycare and childcare settings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Murray, in terms of how it affects your work, I know you're mainly in the emergency room, but what are you concerned about regarding schedules?
Well, the kids who get the most vaccines, as Dr. Cook mentioned, are the youngest ones, so normally at 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months. And we know that those children, especially those under 3 months, if they get a fever, it's a very significant medical concern, because we know that their bodies work a little bit differently, and we get very concerned that they could very easily become overwhelmed by an infection. And when a child is vaccinated at those age groups, the vaccine-preventable diseases that they're usually receiving vaccines for are some of the ones that we worry about the most, causing really devastating illness in those youngest children. So, you know, I think that if we have a batch of younger children that are behind in that youngest age group, you know, when they do present with fevers, it might have to change a little bit about their evaluation. We might be needing to keep children in the hospital a little bit more. It's hard to know. We'll have to see. But we know that when children who have not received any vaccinations have illnesses with fevers, we do have to treat them a little differently, because we know these illnesses are still in our community. And we have to be very, very thorough versus a child who is fully vaccinated and has a fever. We know that they've got the protection against some of the most dangerous diseases, and we can evaluate them a little bit differently. So I think that we are probably in a good place here, again, especially for the youngest children. But if this cycle happens multiple times, I would be concerned that we would start to lose some of the protection that our community is offered by a robust vaccine system.
Mm-hmm. We have a few questions coming in from parents, and I'll get to those in just a moment. And Paul and Pavilion, if you're still listening, call back. I think we lost you on the phone. But in terms of some of these questions have to do with what kinds of precautions our office is taking. And Dr. Topa, I know you mentioned some of the steps that your office has taken. But some folks would like to know, are there mobile units being considered for Monroe County, mobile vaccination units like what we see in Boston, as I mentioned in the intro? Dr. Shipley?
We are not considering mobile units at this time, especially because all the primary care practices are open, both within Monroe County and all the surrounding counties. So, again, I kind of coming back around to what I had said before, it's more than vaccines. It's more than vaccines, although they're really essential. For our youngest children, as everybody said, up through age two, those children are seen almost every 2 months to 3 months because they are getting their primary series of vaccines. These are things like Haemophilus influenza B, which causes meningitis and death in young children. We don't see that now, but we did used to see that even when I was in my residency training 20 years ago. You know, we have, these are vaccines that prevent against tetanus, against pertussis, against measles. That primary series is so important during that first 2 years, and the booster series that children get during that time have to be completed in a timely fashion. So when you ask about, you know, what are those windows, that 0 to 2 is a very, very critical window, and that is exactly why we prioritize that group. You move from there to a series of a booster series that has to happen between age 4 and 5. And so that's another, you know, key area in terms of immunizations. But if you think about it, if your practices are open and can see patients safely, those routine preventive visits we do for children are to assess their growth, to assess a physical exam, to make sure that you can monitor for things that need to be caught earlier if there's a concern for a young developing child, and to do all the important things around development like Dr. Topa was speaking about. And beyond that, the next group of kids, when you talk about vaccines, you really think about our preteen group, because they're getting then some new vaccines at that stage that are really critical, again, vaccines that prevent against meningitis, and then booster vaccines for tetanus and for pertussis.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Topa, when you're thinking about that window that Dr. Shipley just mentioned, maybe you're getting calls from parents, families that are concerned, they want to wait, and you realize as their physician, you know, now's the time to come in. How do you talk to them to try to alleviate some of those fears that they might have, which are real fears? I don't want anyone listening to think that we're judging parents for skipping appointments or canceling. There are concerns. But as you've all been mentioning, the facilities here in Monroe County are doing a pretty good job of keeping, are doing a great job of keeping places safe and taking precautions. So, Dr. Topa, what do those conversations sound like in your office?
Well, trust me, their same fears about keeping their children safe are the same fears we have about, you know, their children, about our staff. The last thing we would want to see would be to see multiple members of our staff actually get ill as well, because they are more at risk than, say, our own patients, unfortunately. The benefit, or I guess one of the upsides as being a pediatrician, is that this illness doesn't seem to severely affect children as much. So a lot of what we go through is more to protect older family members that may be living with the children, or, like I said, around staff members. And so what we do is we usually go through the list of things that we've implemented at the office to help protect patients and staff. And so that includes we do phone screening for every visit that comes in to look to see if anyone at home has been sick with COVID, any sick contacts, whether the child has been ill in the prior 2 weeks. And then we cohort all of our well visits in the morning right now, bringing in well visits at a time when there's no other sick visits being scheduled. We go ahead and we clean each room deeply between each visit. We go ahead and we're all wearing masks and gloves to help protect the families as well. And then in the afternoon, we have a time period where we have our what we call a more of a contagious visit time block, where We bring those patients in who have signs of any infectious disease, whether it's runny nose or throat, fever, cough, diarrhea, and we have them come in through a different door. And it's literally about 2 feet from the one door that they step into to the one exam room that we use only for these type of sick visits. And again, it's only the doctor who's assigned to see those types of visits that day who sees these patients, so they're not going in and out of other rooms. None of our nursing staff is coming into contact with these patients because we have them wait out in their cars in the parking lot, and then I'll go out, or one of the other providers will go out in their mask, face shield, gloves, gown, and goggles, and get people from their cars, basically, and then bring them into the office, and then fastidiously cleaning everything as well. So those are the steps that we're taking, and in my conversations with other pediatric offices, they're doing many of the same things.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading about some of those right now, administering vaccines in the parking lot, staggering appointment times. Are you having conversations with pediatricians nationally about some of these steps, or how does that work when you're coordinating? Is this a countywide effort? Is it a national conversation?
You know, there are a lot of countywide conversations that are being held at the level of the individual provider organizations, such as AHP and then GRIPPA are the two major ones in town. And then some of us also belong to a nationwide listserv that is maintained by the American Academy of Pediatrics that allows practice owners, physicians, to basically bounce ideas off each other. And we're getting feedback from folks in Seattle, from individuals in the New York City area, down south. And so it's interesting to see how individual practices respond, but we are all learning from each other, and I'd say we're all well-informed in making these decisions that we are.
Mm-hmm. A few listeners over the past month or so have sent in questions about transmission among children and saying, thank goodness this disease does not seem to impact kids as frequently or as severely, but they have concerns about kids being transmitters. So even if we're taking precautions everywhere we go, if families are being as careful as they can, what should parents know regarding transmission and the disease itself when it comes to kids? And I ask this question in part because when we see the numbers from the county every day, over the last maybe couple weeks, we've seen a male under the age of 10 who's been diagnosed, or a female between the age of 10 and 19. I think those were some of the more recent numbers. Very small numbers, but what does that mean for kids, Dr. Murray?
I think it means that we can really ask our kids to help. We know that they can get the disease and they can pass it along, but if they have symptoms, they're probably much more mild than adults. There have certainly throughout the country been some cases of much more severe illness in younger children, but in general, they're just not bothered by it as much. But the flip side of that is, you know, this does definitely impact them because of they're scared, their lives have been changed. And it's certainly just like us as adults, they feel a little bit of a lack of control of what's going on. So I think it's a great opportunity for us to say, boy, you know what, you really can help a lot by making sure you're doing a great job washing your hands, by following these rules where if we do need to go out somewhere, we really need you to stay away from other people, not going up and giving your friend a hug, or this is why you can't have a play date, or if we go out and for kids over 2 years of age, you need to wear a mask. I mean, I think we have an opportunity to really empower our children to have some control in this situation that's otherwise very out of control. It is unusual that they don't become so symptomatic. We know usually with respiratory illnesses, we hear of children really becoming so ill. And so it is a little bit nice that they don't have those severe symptoms. But on the other hand, I think we have to remember that anybody is potentially at risk, and that the tricky thing here is that kids could certainly have it and spread the germ with really having no symptoms. So we all need to be following these rules of wearing masks if we have to go out and staying home when we can and maintaining physical distancing, but not social distancing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the social emotional piece of this must be so difficult for kids. Being out of school, not seeing their friends, not seeing grandparents, family members. What can parents do, Dr. Shipley, to try to bridge some of those gaps before things go back to, I don't want to say normal, but back to some semblance of what we were experiencing before.
I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I think that the emotional distress and the social emotional connection for our kids needs to become part of the ongoing conversation. You know, kids are suffering significantly. I mean, as Liz so appropriately said, you know, they don't appear to be getting sick or seriously ill from coronavirus, but they really are sustaining collateral damage from this pandemic. There was a study that was just a poll that was just released from Raising New York that shows that 75% of families are seeing signs of significant emotional distress in their children. 11% of parents have had to limit food for their kids, and a third are limiting food for themselves because of the economic impact of this pandemic. And I think that we are appropriately focusing on protecting adults, but our community has got to mobilize around our kids to assure that they are supported and protected in this. So I think some of the things that parents can do and families can do are, you know, giving kids connection to their adult supports outside of their family. So reaching out to their child's school, to their teachers, or to the support folks in the school districts who are still there, even though this is all remote learning. It's education and it's social-emotional well-being. That's what comes from being connected, whether you're in the very earliest childhood setting in an early pre-K classroom, or whether you're, you know, not finishing, you know, your senior year in school, but still finishing your senior year as a high school student. And so I think making those connections and reaching out to your child's doctors or to other supports within your family, helping make those connections are really, really important. So many children are experiencing anxiety. We're seeing higher rates of depression. And it's not just the children, it's their families, it's the whole unit. So one of the things that's happening right now that I'm excited about is our primary care practices are reaching out proactively to families that aren't scheduled to be coming in right now, but to reach out and check in and see how families are doing. Are there basic needs that they're struggling with now that they could receive support and help for? Are there these emotional concerns and distress that our teams could help families with? And it's not just primary care offices, not just pediatricians and family doctors and nurse practitioners. Schools are doing exactly the same thing. And our behavioral health specialists across the community are doing the same thing. And we're coordinating that together. You know, our goal in this is we are going to create the tightest woven safety net for all of our community's kids, so we don't have anybody fall through the cracks. And it's really our responsibility as a community to put kids at the front of every conversation and at every meeting now, because we don't want them to have sustained fallout from this.
Mm-hmm. We've spoken a lot about trauma on this program when it comes to kids who are growing up in poverty or kids who have difficult family structures and lives at home, and how schools can help deal with some of that and help them through it. And I think this is a time when trauma may be compounding the trauma that they're already experiencing. So when it comes to kids who are living in poverty, what types of resources are out there for families, either when it comes to information or access to basic daily needs, that if someone's listening and they know of someone, where can they find that? I'll open that up to any of you who may have some insight there.
So this is Dave. I'm a big fan of Kids Thrive 585. It's a website locally that tries to compile resources available for issues that families may run into across the spectrum, whether it's food insecurity, safety, emotional well-being, and that usually serves as a good local resource. So then I always like to refer my patients to the American Academy of Pediatrics. They have a website called healthychild.org. or healthychildren.org, which can give them some good guidance as well and links to expertise. The New York Times has a parenting listserv, or I guess email blast, that comes out that's been very helpful as well. And just to piggyback off what LJ was saying, I think the new, the new car smell, the new schedule smell has worn off. I think the initially a lot of kids, especially some of mine that had anxiety or mood-related issues, especially related to stressors at school or being overscheduled, adjusted quite well to the schedule in the first few weeks. But now I'm starting to see the wheels start to wobble a little bit here where a lot of these kids are beginning to realize, wait a second, we may not be returning to, quote, normal. And that is, I think, causing a rebound in some of their anxiety and their mood concerns. And mm-hmm. So I think right now is probably one of the most at-risk times for these children that have a history of anxiety or mood issues or may have been borderline. And luckily, I think a lot of pediatricians in the area and people who take care of children really do are in touch, and they know who their at-risk children are and families are and are able to reach out to each of those families.
Listeners, if you have questions for the experts, now is your time to talk with them directly. The number to call is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@WXXI.org, and you can find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, more with our guests on how some of these vaccine rates dropping across the country could have a broader impact on public health and also perceptions of vaccines in this country. So short break, more Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we welcome author Chris Arnotti. His book is called Dignity. It explores the communities that often feel forgotten in this country. Arnotti worries that the pandemic could hurt poor communities in disproportionate ways. He explains how inequality is characterizing this crisis. Talk to you Tuesday. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. I want to take just one moment and talk about what things look like here at WXXI right now. As we talk about physical distancing and being safe, how to protect kids and families, I want to reassure everyone listening we're doing our part here at WXXI. There are very few people in our building. Everyone is working hard at home. Our engineer, Rob, is showing off this new tub of wipes that we have for the booth. So everyone's physically distanced, wearing masks, and we realize how important this is, too. So we are joining forces with everyone in this community to try to stop the spread of this virus. We are discussing how vaccination rates are dropping across the country, not here in Monroe County, fortunately, but across the country, as parents are expressing some fears of their families contracting the virus. And we're looking at some numbers. I have some broader questions for our guests about what this means in terms of public health. My guests this hour are Dr. Stephen Cook, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center and Medical Director at the New York State Department of Health, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, Professor, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Emergency Medicine at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong, Dr. Laura Jean Shipley, Associate Medical Director for Accountable Health Partners and Vice Chair for Behavioral and Population Health in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Dr. David Topa, pediatrician at Pittsford Pediatric Associates. During the break, Dr. Cook sent me something that says 211 is a lifeline for a region, as it's an excellent resource for families who may be struggling. Dr. Cook, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're, you know, again, Rochester has some amazing things, and the 211 lifeline service, which serves about 5-6 counties in our area, Monroe, Ontario, Wayne, Livingston, Seneca, and Cayuga. A few years ago, they reformatted their web page. It's mobile accessible that when you come to the first landing page, it has on their topics you're looking for support, food, housing, mental health, substance abuse, legal, housing items. And you can click on any one of those, and you can put in your county, you can put in a zip code, and it'll search on a radius around a zip code, and it'll list what resources are available there. And importantly, it'll have the information about the resource. You know, we'll use this with families in a room and show it to them. And I'll explain to them, click on the link, because, you know, maybe it says, you know, the First Lutheran Church has a food pantry that's open, but it's open Tuesdays and Thursdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Or it's a community agency that takes referrals only, or something that can only be accessed once a month. But it is actually a resource that's been in place for a couple years, and Lifeline does an outstanding job of maintaining that web page source and the data that's there. So it's very analogous to what we're looking for, and I think it's been a real help in our region prior to all this. But as you've heard on the phone here, a lot of providers and agencies are rallying to this call, and specifically to children because they are more vulnerable.
211 or 211.org for all of that. Thank you, Dr. Cook. I have a question for our guests about conversations about vaccines as a result of this pandemic. And we could go in a bunch of different directions here, but I want to start with the flu vaccine. And I'll start with Dr. Murray. Do you expect that this pandemic will inspire more people to get the flu vaccine in the fall?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and I don't know, because I'm just not sure that families actually even have the bandwidth right now to think that far ahead. We have definitely seen some people of the anti-vaccine movement, not the vaccine hesitant or vaccine questioning people. I'm speaking about something very different. The true people who are against vaccinations are really trying to link in to the potential dangers of a COVID vaccine. However, you know, we don't have a vaccine yet for it. So I would caution against any concern about a vaccine that hasn't even been created yet. You know, certainly anything we can do to keep our population as healthy as possible as we come into the next winter season is going to be beneficial. And so we've seen the ravages of a disease that we can't prevent in any way other than the hand washing and the physical distancing and the things that people really don't enjoy doing. And so it is certainly my hope that people will have a greater appreciation for the flu vaccine to gain and glean any possible protection against another very awful illness.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Topa, the flu vaccine's effectiveness is a moving target because the virus mutates. What do you tell patients or parents, more likely parents, who use that as a reason not to get the flu vaccination for their kids or even themselves?
Well, I think it's important to remind everyone that there's no such thing as a perfect vaccine, meaning one that's going to work all the time for all people. The thing that I remind my families about in the practice is that while the vaccine may not prevent you from getting the flu, it's going to help prevent you from becoming seriously ill from the flu, or it'll keep you from being hospitalized with the flu, or if you're hospitalized, keep you from dying from the flu. We do know that there are benefits to it, which go beyond just preventing the flu. I mean, it does seem to prevent serious illness. And, you know, being a practitioner who, you know, every year I swim in the flu because we've got kids in the office with it. And I'd say in the last 20 years, I've had true flu about three times. And every time I get it, it reminds me why I get the flu vaccine, because, you know, I'd assume that I'd get it every year if it wasn't for it. Again, it's not a great scientific study there, but at the same point, I oftentimes use my own story to help reinforce the benefits of the flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that most parents have questions, they're confused, or are they resisting vaccines in general, those that you're talking about?
You mean the ones who have questions about the flu
vaccine?
About
the flu vaccine, yeah.
No. There's a range. I mean, I've had a number of families who they will go ahead and gladly accept the your typical flu or your typical vaccinations that are part of your standard childhood schedule, and then they just defer the flu vaccine. Luckily, in my practice, I don't have many individuals who are truly unvaccinated. I think as a practitioner, early on when I established a relationship with the family, we come to the realization that if they don't really embrace the effectiveness of vaccines and will consent to vaccination, that we're going to disagree on a number of other things going forward. And in that situation, it's hard to establish a good therapeutic relationship with the family. And oftentimes, they'll either choose not to come to me or they'll go to another practice.
Mm-hmm. I ask that question because most experts don't expect a coronavirus vaccine to be 100%, 95% effective. But if a coronavirus vaccine ends up in the same category of effectiveness as a flu vaccine, I'm wondering if patients and parents will be hesitant to get that. Or is this different? Do you think people are reacting differently to the coronavirus? I'll start with Dr. Shipley.
I think, like Elizabeth said, I think it's tough to tell right now. I do think that people are taking the coronavirus very, very seriously. And I think that it's helped us all recognize how much we're in this together in terms of the actions that we take for our kids can have a huge impact on the health of their grandparents or our elderly neighbor next door or other adults within our families and our communities. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation as we go forward. And I mean, it's not imminent. That vaccine is going to take time to be able to develop and assure safety before it's actually utilized. But I do hope that people will recognize what Dr. Topa just said, you know, even if it doesn't prevent the disease, if it minimizes the spread, if it minimizes the impact to an individual, that's a huge benefit. And because we've seen what happens with an unchecked infectious disease that there is no treatment for. Mm-hmm. And none of us have ever seen this. We joke sometimes because some of our trainees or medical students will ask us, you know, have you ever seen anything like this before? And we haven't, nor have our retired pediatricians who are, you know, in their 80s. This is novel to all of us, and we're all learning a lot as we go. But we are responsible for each other across the whole community, and I hope it will help people, you know, ask questions, have conversations with their primary care doctors. You know, it's a partnership when you are a pediatrician and you're taking care of someone's child. It's not a dictatorship. But if it's a good partnership, you have those conversations to listen, to understand what someone is afraid of, what they're worried about, what they're uncertain about in your guidance and recommendations. And then you continue that dialogue and conversation, and hopefully you're able to establish that trusting relationship that Dave Topa just talked about.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you saying there's so much that we don't know at this stage about this virus, about a vaccination. Researchers are working around the clock, around the world, to try to find some answers. Governor Cuomo, earlier today, between 11:30 and 12:30, spoke about it's okay to say you don't know. And I think there's danger sometimes when we bite off more than we can chew. But what we do know is that vaccinations can prevent things like measles, diphtheria, and other issues we've talked about on the show. And when I look at the data surrounding vaccine rates dropping across the country, looking at some data from the New York Times right now, using the week of February 16th as a pre-coronavirus baseline, researchers found that during the week of April 5th, the administration of measles, mumps, and rubella shots dropped by 50%, diphtheria and whooping cough shots dropped by 42%, and HPV vaccines by 73%. So I'll turn this over to my guest. When you look at those numbers changing, are you concerned about a second public health crisis when it comes to something like measles? Again, last year, the U.S. nearly losing its measles elimination status. Dr. Cook, how does that resonate with you?
I have that as a primary focus. I mean, I think it's very important, not just the physical barriers and access barriers that we're running into of having a social distance and having kind of limited in-person contact, but then the questions, concerns, and fears that arise around vaccines and that families are getting hesitant. I mean, looking at flu rates and cases in the state over the past 4 years, not that these numbers are huge, but 6 to 8 children have died from influenza per season in New York, except this past year, 13 died. You know, and it's small numbers, but it, you know, is this a warning sign that just the baseline flu vaccine is getting questioned, whether it's questioned, whether it's cautious, whether the refusers, whether it's just anxious and hesitant. So we really have to be aware of this because you're right. There are conditions out here that, you know, our trainees haven't seen. Some of us haven't seen in a long time. I had a student ask me about chickenpox. I said, not only have I seen it, I had it. But that made me feel super old, as you can imagine. So you're right. We have a number of things here. And it's really sad because this is what public health is about. We do this. We do this job and prevent so many things that people forget what it is we're doing. And the fact of herd immunity, which people talk about, we're not going to get to herd immunity in this country very quickly. It's going to take a while. It's going to require lots of cases, and we just don't know, you know, what that may lead to. And the more cases there are, the more risk of this virus mutating and having trouble with that. So let's not create other infectious disease problems by undermining or avoiding very evidence-based, very scientifically-based and safe therapies and vaccines.
Thank you. I hope that the parents who are listening to the show and had concerns about going to local medical facilities have heard some answers. And in our last few minutes, I'd just like to give each of our guests an opportunity to just send anything you want to local families who have expressed these concerns. What do you want people to know, whether it's about coronavirus-related issues, about vaccines? The floor is yours, and I know that our guests, our listeners appreciate so much giving or having a chance to listen to you for nearly a full hour on a talk show. So thank you. And let's start with Dr. Topa. What message would you like to send to families?
Don't hesitate to reach out to us. Reach out to your own family's provider if you have questions about either how your child is coping with the new stressors, about how other family members might be coping with it, or concerns about, okay, is it safe to come into the office? We all try to establish a good relationship with our families. That's why we went into primary care. And it's important to us to be able to continue with that. And many of us do have a little more time on our hands now to spend with families as well. And so just reach out to us. That's what we're here for.
Great. Dr. Shipley.
I think I'd want parents to know that if they have difficulty with transportation, if they normally rely on public transportation, we even have arranged for safe transport for families to come individually through a partnership with RTS. And so if that's a something that is holding you back from coming to your doctor's appointment, please don't let it. And I would just echo what Dave said. You know, the measure of a community is how they care for their children. And we want to take the very, very best care of all of our children. So if we can make children the center of all of our conversations the whole time we're still focusing on adults, and if we can protect children by getting them in for these critical visits, there will be other areas of our country, of our state, where immunization rates, we know it, are dropping. We want to protect our kids here, not just from vaccine preventable illness, but we want to protect them so they can stay on track, they can thrive despite being in a very stressful and very uncertain time.
You mentioned I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, and just build connections for your kids. What Dave said, call your doctor, check in with their school, and ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask for help. People will be reaching to you, but feel comfortable reaching out to those trusted individuals who really care about your child.
You mentioned the RTS service, 53 small buses, the RTS access buses, shuttling parents who don't have transportation to well child visits. What's the best way for families to connect with that RTS service?
What they need to do is actually contact their doctor's office. That is how the transportation is being arranged. It's a wonderful story in the midst of all this, and I think something really unique to our community. Your pediatrician or family physician's office will make that connection with RTS, set that transport up, and they will come to your door, bring you to your appointment, and take you home.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Murray, we're down to our last few minutes. Your message to families.
That healthcare will look different moving forward. And, you know, as we redesign it, it's not because we did something we weren't doing it right in the past. It's because we faced a new challenge, and so we're going to rise to a new challenge. Pretty soon we're going to see images of even our Sandy Strong wearing a mask. And so things will look different, and kids need to understand that too, that it might look a little scarier going to the doctor, but there's a good reason for it. And this redesign is to help keep everybody safe.
Thank you. Dr. Cook, you have the last word. No pressure.
No pressure at all. Thank you very much. Wash your hands. Don't touch your faces. But, I mean, all those are important. And, you know, the Rochester region has responded very well. It's why our rates are lower and why we as a region are being looked at to reopen sooner. Right down the road in Buffalo and Erie County, the rates are much higher. So we've done a good job. The hospitals are prepared. The hospitals may be one of the safer areas to be in because everyone's masked and gowning and using face shields and washing their hands vigorously. Having a niece who's pregnant who has to have a C-section, she was explained that she was going to be getting a test before she got, she was going to be tested before she comes in. Her husband would be as well. They would be there. We are at a different place than when we were 4 or 5 weeks ago with equipment and space and staff. So the community has really stepped up. Call your doctor and communicate with them.
I'll post some links to how you can read more about each of our guests and their work in the community on the podcast page. And I would like to thank all of them for not only taking the time to join me this hour and share their insight with you, our listeners, but also for all the work that you do in the community every day. Thank you so much. Dr. Stephen Cook, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, Dr. Laura Jean Shipley, and Dr. David Topa. Thank you.
And thank you. Stay well, everyone.
Yes, stay well. And thank you for listeners. It's been another informative day on Connections. Evan will be back tomorrow. My thanks to our engineer, Rob Braden, on double duty today with phones. Thanks for your help. Emery Stein's our intern. I'm Megan Mack sitting in today. More Connections tomorrow. Stay safe. Talk to you.